It's a pleasure to be here and to see a lot of very familiar faces and a lot of old friends to talk about a very, very important topic. My only regret is I didn't have a chance to actually come and listen and be part of these earlier discussions. We've been working hard on the other important parts of my portfolio in India. The Secretary has the strategic dialogue coming up in India, and of course Bangladesh labor problems and all of the other manner of problems. So I didn't really have a chance to come, but I'm looking forward to reading the reports, and I've already gotten a nice little download from Ambassador Simons. I think it's a particularly relevant time to be talking about Islam and Central Asia. As all of you have been discussing, this is a time of great change in the region. Just 2 days ago, our Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, and all of his NATO counterparts met in Brussels to plan a new NATO mission for the post-2014 era to train, advise, and assist Afghan forces. And of course, the process of Afghans assuming full responsibility for security is already well underway. We're also helping Afghanistan to transition economically to more private sector and trade-led growth, and of course, less dependence on aid. And then there's the political transition that's going on in Afghanistan as Afghanistan's electoral institutions prepare for what will be really critical elections in 2014, both for the at the presidential and the provincial council level. In our view, credible and inclusive elections will be a very, very important milestone for Afghanistan's political transition. And so amidst all of that change, there is understandably considerable anxiety in the region, in Central Asia and beyond, about the impact of our troop drawdown on regional security. And despite the real gains in stability in Afghanistan, despite the Afghan National Security Forces' enhanced capabilities, and the absence of major recent terrorist incidents in the Central Asian states, there continues to be a shared concern in the region that a reduction in the international force presence in Afghanistan will lead violent extremist groups such as the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan to focus their attention once again on Central Asia. And there is also some fear across the region that Central Asian facilitation of the Northern Distribution Network, which is increasingly important for our shipments coming out of Afghanistan, could invite terrorist retribution against those states. Some observers have gone even further, predicting dark scenarios of Central Asia falling to extremist Islamic groups coming out of Afghanistan as the United States, they say, loses interest in the region after 2014. And I'm here to tell you that these concerns are misplaced for a number of important reasons. First, the United States is not pulling out of the region. On the contrary, we are committed to an enduring partnership with Afghanistan and its people in the years ahead, and of course, with the governments and the people of Central Asia. As the President has said several times, as Afghans stand up, they will not stand alone. And a very important part of that is continuing to engage with Afghanistan's neighbors in Central Asia and elsewhere, as Deputy Secretary of State Bill Burns and I did quite recently at the Heart of Asia Ministerial in Almaty that took place about a month ago. And our goal, of course, remains to work towards a secure, stable, and prosperous Afghanistan within a secure, stable, and prosperous and integrated region. A second and important factor about why those fears are misplaced is the nature of Islam in Central Asia. Islam has a long and peaceful tradition in Central Asia. It has been a central feature of the cultural life of the region for more than a millennium. As the hub of the Silk Road, Central Asian cities flourished as bastions of Islamic learning and scientific thought, making enormous contributions to science and culture. And those of you who have had the privilege of traveling to Central Asia, as I have, know of the grandeur of the Rijistan and Samarkand, and the beauty of the madrasas and caravanserais of Bukhara, and so many other treasures. Today we pay homage to those traditions in the State Department by cooperating with governments and civil society across the region to try to preserve these historically significant Islamic heritage that exists. As this audience knows very well, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, the people of the region have rediscovered their Islamic heritage and rekindled beliefs and practices that were lost or obscured during the Soviet era. But many controls and restrictions on freedom of religion persist, a risk that I will return to later. A small number of people have turned to radicalism and violence. We know that several Islamist militant groups with ties to Central Asia have spent much of the last decade operating out of Pakistan and Afghanistan and claim credit for attacks on Afghan and coalition forces or targets inside the region. Groups such as the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan are likely to continue to operate in northern Afghanistan while looking for opportunities to expand their currently limited presence in Central Asia. These groups, however, number in the tens or hundreds, not in the thousands, and do not pose an imminent threat to Central Asian states. Their violent ideology is overwhelmingly rejected by the people of Central Asia. And while counterterrorism capabilities are uneven across the region, they have generally proven sufficient to prevent groups from establishing secure operational bases in any of the Central Asian states. But the limited threat currently posed by Islamic militancy in Central Asia and the failure of radical ideology to take root are no reason for complacency. Central Asian states face real security challenges, not only from violent extremists, but also from cross-border threats such as drug trafficking and from organized crime. Our security assistance aims to strengthen the ability of Central Asian states to address a broad range of such threats. In 2012, the United States provided approximately $215 million of security assistance to the countries of Central Asia through a combination of Department of State, Department of Defense, and Department of Energy programs. The bulk of this assistance is focused on strengthening border security and increasing the capabilities of law enforcement agencies to counter transnational criminal activity, including terrorism, drug trafficking, and trafficking in persons and nonproliferation. Turning to some of our specific priorities, the Anti-Terrorism Assistance Program is active in 4 of the 5 Central Asian countries and supports stronger border control and investigative capabilities. We are engaged in talks with the 5th country, Uzbekistan, to relaunch the program there as well. Through our Central Asia Regional Strategic Initiative, we are encouraging greater counterterrorism cooperation in the border areas of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, while the FBI is providing tools such as the automated fingerprint information system to countries such as Uzbekistan. Our interest in combating terrorism and other cross-border threats is shared by others, so we are also engaging with other countries and with international organizations that are active in Central Asia to cooperate on regional security and stability. I have made it a personal priority to expand our consultations with Russia and China on Central Asia. Since 2006, over 2,000 counter-narcotics officers from Afghanistan, Pakistan, and all 5 Central Asian states have received training through a NATO-Russia joint project called the NATO-Russia Council Counter-Narcotics Training Project. In Dushanbe, the United States and Russia both play leading roles in managing the OSCE Border Management Staff College, which provides important specialized training for senior management of border security agencies from across Central Asia, the wider OSCE region, and Afghanistan. I just visited the college in February and came away very impressed with the range of training that's going on and the range of officials that I was able to meet there, who are doing very, very practical work together. The Central Asian states share many of our security objectives in the region, and they've been good partners in this cooperation, particularly on the security front. But they also face a broad range of challenges that, as in many other societies, could fuel radicalism over time if left unaddressed. As they have sought to reduce their country's vulnerability to perceived terrorist threats, they have at times failed to distinguish clearly between things like the right to peaceful worship and the need to combat religious extremism. Some have used the threat of extremism as a reason to repress political opposition, media freedom, and civil society. We know that in most cases in Central Asia, the principal threats are not from violent extremist groups, but rather internal. Growing restrictions on the exercise of a range of democratic freedoms and lack of economic opportunity. Non-religious factors such as denial of political rights and civil liberties, significant restrictions on the ability of civil society to organize, to organize, receive funding, and operate, corruption, transnational crime, limitations on freedom of expression and conscience, weak rule of law, and leadership succession questions, all are more likely to trigger the kind of protracted instability that could threaten the security and interests of the Central Asian states themselves and of the United States and our allies. Tajikistan, for example, has circumscribed the role of Islamist groups in society, and in some cases has imposed restrictions on religious freedom, including banning women from attending mosques and imposing restrictions on wearing the hijab in school. Law enforcement and judicial bodies in Uzbekistan have continued to use charges of terrorism and alleged extremist ties, not only as grounds to arrest, prosecute, and convict suspected terrorists, but also to suppress legitimate expression of political or religious beliefs. The government of Kazakhstan has cited the threat of violent extremism to justify recent limitations on political opposition and the media. When governments in the region employ methods to counter radicalization and violent extremism that are inconsistent with respect for the fundamental rights of citizens and the rule of law, they undermine long-term stability rather than strengthen it. Freedom of expression and an active civil society, far from being threats, are valuable feedback mechanisms that can help governments be more responsive, and they're pressure release valves that provide societies with peaceful means to air grievances. Likewise, weak rule of law and pervasive corruption have a corrosive effect on the Central Asian states, undermining the confidence of people in their governments and their ability to attract investments necessary to spur broad-based economic growth. And the tendency to blame neighbors and outsiders for problems within one's own borders hinders the kind of cooperation needed to address transnational challenges and to seize new economic opportunities. To address these challenges, our engagement with Central Asia goes beyond the security assistance that I outline, to also encourage meaningful and sustainable progress on human rights and democratic reforms, and advocate for the New Silk Road vision of greater regional economic cooperation and integration. To achieve these objectives, we use a combination of diplomatic engagement and bilateral and multilateral assistance. On the diplomatic front, the annual consultations that we hold each year with each of the five Central Asian countries form the cornerstone of our bilateral relationships. They provide us a venue to not only review the full range of priorities in our relations with senior government officials, but also to deepen our engagement with civil society and build stronger economic ties. In these engagements, we consistently underscore the importance of protecting fundamental civil and political liberties, including the rights of ethnic, religious, and other minorities. We urge governments across the region to ensure space for civil society, the media, political activists, and religious actors to operate freely and peacefully so they can contribute to the advancement of their countries. And we stress to our Central Asian friends that these issues, like our security cooperation, are integral aspects of the bilateral relationship, and that lack of progress in one area hinders our ability to move forward in others. We are clear-eyed about these issues, and progress is, quite frankly, slow and halting. The instinctive reaction in the region to upcoming leadership successions and elections is to tighten control. And Russia's recent efforts to curb activities of independent NGOs have found their echo in Central Asia. But we also have seen some positive results in our engagement. During the last round of our annual consultations in Tashkent, for example, the government of Uzbekistan organized for the first time a civil society forum with independent civil society members. And I was heartened by the frankness of the dialogue that did take place there. So, of course, we want to continue and try to build on that. Our engagement on these issues also takes the form of assistance programs designed to improve compliance with international human rights standards and principles of government accountability and transparency. In FY 2012, we provided $26 million to support such efforts. In addition, in Kyrgyzstan, we are supporting security sector reform, which, along with assistance in the judicial sector, is helping to strengthen the rule of law and bring about what we hope will be a fairer and more transparent judicial system. In Tajikistan, we have a very successful community policing program that is working at the grassroots level to build trust between law enforcement, local government, civil society, and the community to address local problems related to crime and security. Such programs help to stabilize communities in vulnerable areas like the Rasht Valley and Khorog, while encouraging policing methods that are consistent with respect for human rights and the rule of law. We are also exploring how to tailor projects to counter violent extremism to offer positive alternatives to local communities that are most at risk. These programs have proven effective in other parts of the world and are designed to reduce the vulnerability of targeted or at-risk segments of the population to the appeal of violent extremism. We see this as a promising avenue for helping our Central Asian partners strengthen their defenses against the threat of terrorism and violent extremism, while at the same time encouraging a respect for fundamental rights of citizens that are essential to the long-term stability of the region. That long-term stability requires not just defenses against threats, but also a positive vision for the future. And that's why we have championed so strongly the New Silk Road vision of greater regional economic cooperation and integration. Increased connectivity and integration and trade between Central Asia and Afghanistan, South Asia, and Europe will help forge the physical, cultural, and commercial links that can be the building blocks for a more stable, secure, and prosperous future in the region. This is especially true for Afghanistan, where an important economic transition is underway and where increased economic integration with the wider region can also support efforts to improve security and bring a political end to the war in Afghanistan. To take just one example, the proposed Turkmenistan-Afghanistan-Pakistan-India pipeline, or TAPI, would connect the vast gas reserves of Turkmenistan with the hungry energy markets of South Asia, while providing much-needed transit revenue to Pakistan and Afghanistan. While we have a long way to go, TAPI is closer to reality today than many would have thought possible even 2 years ago. And trade liberalization, the software side, if you will, is no less important than physical infrastructure. And there, too, we are seeing encouraging signs. Kyrgyzstan was the very first Central Asian state to join the World Trade Organization. Tajikistan acceded earlier this year. Afghanistan and Kazakhstan are well along in their accession processes. And Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan have shown renewed interest in the WTO, which we strongly support because we believe that transparent and inclusive trade regimes benefit everyone and increase economic opportunity for the people of Central Asia. So let me conclude by stressing that while it can be a slow and challenging process to accomplish far-reaching change, I am optimistic about the future of the region and about our engagement with the governments and people of Central Asia. Islam clearly will feature as an important dimension of Central Asia's development and one to which we must give due attention. And I think your conference will add to our understanding of these important currents. But the core issues ahead for Central Asia remain squarely centered on the need for continued progress in political and economic reform, where we will continue to work together. As the transitions in Afghanistan continue, we will continue to work with our Central Asian partners to tackle the shared challenges posed by transnational criminal activity, to develop more open societies, and to bring about more connectivity and economic opportunity in the region. This region, at the crossroads of East and West, surrounded by some of the most dynamic economies in the world today, is much too important for us to walk away from. So with that, I'd like to just, again, thank so much the organizers for the opportunity to talk with you today. And as Tom said, I'd be glad to take some questions. And Tom reminds me that those also are on the record. Thank you very much. Well, I mean, Iran obviously remains a central threat in terms of its desire to acquire nuclear weapons. So we believe that the best way to encourage them to be more cooperative with the P5+1 efforts is to steadily increase economic pressure on them. Iran in the future could be an important market and could be an important part of this regional integration vision, but the regional integration effort is not going to falter because of the fact that Iran is not part of it. We have Turkey, we have Russia, we have India, and many other countries who are very much committed to this process, and I think that already we're seeing progress on that.
Other questions? Wait for the mic. Here we go. Down here.
Thank you. My question is concrete. What are perspectives of relationship between Kurdistan and the United States if in December 2015 we'll close transit center Manas? Because now our president says that international airport of Manas should be associated only with civilian component, not with military. But in Central Asia, particularly in Kurdistan, external players play a very big role. And in this connection, what happens? Thank you.
Well, I don't want to speculate about the future of Manas because we'll have to see. We're engaged in discussions now with the government of Kyrgyzstan about the future of Manas, and we'll have to just see how those talks play out. But let me say that whatever the outcome of those talks, Kyrgyzstan will remain a very important country for us for the simple reason that, first of all, it's the only functioning democracy in the region. President Obama and all of our leaders have expressed very strong support for the democratic transition that has taken place in Kyrgyzstan, and we continue to find ways, as I mentioned in my remarks, to support not only that democratic transition, but things like improving the judicial sector and encouraging greater ethnic integration, because we think it's so important to the stability of that country. So Kyrgyzstan will remain a very, very important country for us, and it remains a focus of our assistance programs. As you know, our assistance programs are across the board are facing some cuts because of the sequestration and other challenges that we're facing. Kyrgyzstan is the only country where we're requesting increases in economic and other kinds of assistance that are not related to the military in any way. So it does show the importance that we attach to Kyrgyzstan.
Other questions?
thought it was a great analysis of the problems facing the regions. I guess my question is related to how that analysis lines up with the policy. So for example, you spoke about the primacy of internally generated threats, and yet when you look at the division of U.S. assistance in a region, you know, even on the sort of macro level of the division between 050 and 150 economic assistance, it's really skewed in the other direction.
Right.
So can you comment on that, please?
Well, first of all, obviously we do have... We have to continue to support our very important security interests while they're while the NDN and so forth are proceeding in Afghanistan. So we obviously need to continue to support that. But as I say, I think security is going to underlie a lot of progress in other areas. So if there can be progress on the security front, we can that can really help. The other problem is that there are limits to what we can do in terms of assistance on the democratic side. I think most of what we can do is on the diplomatic front to try to help these countries. As you know very well, many NGOs are threatened in many of these countries, and the governments are placing restrictions and limits on what kinds of assistance that we can provide to those countries, to those NGOs. So I think we're rubbing up against limitations in that score. So I think that in terms of encouraging democracy, it needs to be both a combination of, you know, diplomatic efforts, continuing to support financially where we can NGOs, and then working through organizations like Freedom House and others to encourage broader democratic change in the region.
From the Voice of America. Has there been any decision made in regards to the requests for military aid to Uzbekistan? Helicopters, other things that Uzbeks have been asking?
No, we're engaged in a, I would say, a calibrated process to work with Uzbekistan. As you know, restrictions remain, and they're under our law for what we can provide in terms of lethal assistance. So we're continuing to provide non-lethal assistance to Uzbekistan. But again, this is a very patient and calibrated process, and we've made clear to our friends in Uzbekistan that there are limits to what we can do as long as a lot of these quite significant human rights problems persist. So it's very, very important that there be progress on the range of issues that I described in my remarks. And were there to be such progress, then we could make a better case in Congress to perhaps lift some of those restrictions and allow for a more fulsome military cooperation program.
Yulia Zachenko, Voice of America, Russian Service. I'm just wondering how you assess the potential of the Russian-American cooperation in the region after the withdrawal, and will Russia become less anxious and more willing to collaborate after the troops are gone from Afghanistan?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I can answer that question. I think that our cooperation with Russia on Afghanistan has been one of the positive aspects of overall cooperation with Russia, and so we want to try to sustain that as much as possible. And I think we want to try to sustain the very positive dialogue which we've had with Russia on Central Asia, and continue to look for ways that we can cooperate on our common interests, like stopping narcotics flows through Central Asia to Russia. I don't want to speculate about what Russia's own ambitions are and how those are going to change after 2014. It's very difficult for me to say. You'll have to really talk to the Russians about that. But I think from our perspective, we will continue to look for ways to try to cooperate with Russia. But we also will continue to try to stress the importance of open markets, and to very much support this WTO accession process that I talked about. As you know, many of countries, and particularly many business people in Central Asia, are concerned about efforts to try to expand the customs union and whether that will cut off trade from the European Union or from the United States or others. So we want to, again, make sure that through accession to the WTO that there will remain open opportunities for all countries, and that, again, there will be an opportunity to establish greater regional integration, not only within Central Asia itself, but with the wider region.
challenges, particularly in the Uyghur case, could be challenges in here, the human rights challenges, that are specific to the current leadership or specific to the regime itself. And the question is really oriented to the broader issues. If there is a change of leadership, do you think there'll be considerably more opportunities to engage Uzbekistan in a way that we really haven't in the past 5 years?
Well, maybe I take slight exception to the premise of the question. I mean, we certainly have engaged them in a very, very serious way on all these questions. It's quite a parlor game to try to speculate about succession issues both in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. So I certainly don't want to do that here. But I think that what we have an interest in doing is to try to encourage change, but also to try to do this in a way that tells the leadership of the region why it's in their own interest to undertake such change. And in some cases, that's difficult for them to understand. And so their natural reaction to challenges is to impose greater controls rather than to open up societies as we are advocating. So I think a lot of the answer to that is also to help encourage bottom-up change. So I think some of the most important things that we do in Central Asia are things like education programs and English language programs and helping people to study in the United States, to have exchange programs of various kinds, because those kinds of people-to-people contacts kind of expose the young people particularly to a different way of thinking, and then they can come back and help to encourage more positive change in their countries. And I think you've seen that with, particularly in Kazakhstan, where the Bolshak program and other numerous other programs have really created a new generation of young Kazakh leaders in not only government, but in the business community and in the wider society. They really have had a positive impact in Kazakhstan. So you really do see, for example, when you go to a place like Nazarbayev University, there's quite an impressive range of very, very free discussion about all the important issues that are taking place. And because of that, you're beginning to see now some of the benefits of that. You're beginning to see investments that are taking place in more kind of innovation types of things and not simply in government government contracts and things like that. And so there's kind of a ripple effect that takes place, and that's the kind of positive change that we'd like to try to see, and exactly to encourage that kind of ripple effect. These kinds of things are going to be slow in Central Asia, but I think it's very, very important to kind of lay the basis for that, and so we're trying to do that in every one of these countries. And I think not just on the part of the United States government, but to the extent we can encourage foundations and others to help support these kind of things, it really helps.
Thanks, Alex Peterson here at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thanks very much, Ambassador Blake, for your remarks. And as I mentioned to you in the past, I would argue that the most consequential external actor at the moment, and certainly going forward in Central Asia, is probably China. So I wonder how you might talk about how our policies are either gelling with the vision that the Chinese may have, both in the economic and the diplomatic sphere, or maybe not gelling.
Well, I think, first of all, I agree with you that China is a very, very important actor, and that's why I spent a lot of my time trying to talk to the Chinese and really engage them as well. And I must say that I've been struck in my dialogues with them that every time we have one, it becomes more and more real and less based on talking points, to the point where the last one we had, we spoke for, I think, 5 hours. We hardly opened our briefing books. We just had a straight conversation, which was really good because there was a much greater real exchange of views. I think obviously we don't agree with the Chinese on everything, particularly on the democratic front, where they have a completely different vision of the way forward. But we certainly think that the Chinese have a very important role to play in the whole regional integration piece of this. And so they've been very active on that. And we'd like to see more of that. I mean, we saw that, for example, in the last CARIC conference that took place in Wuhan, where they've been, you know, I'd say quite an enthusiastic supporter of the CARIC program, which aims, as you all know, to mobilize $20 billion in finance to create these six transport corridors that will help a lot to improve regional economic integration in Central Asia and beyond. And China not only hosted this conference, but now wants to host a new kind of think tank that will be based out in Western China to help to sort of promote this vision. So that's a good thing. We want to try to encourage that. So again, we're not going to always agree with the Chinese on everything about on the way forward in Central Asia and beyond. I think it's really important that we have a dialogue, that we look for ways to cooperate. So far, the Chinese have not been too eager to engage in bilateral cooperation on things like, let's say, counterterrorism or counter-narcotics, even though I would argue that we do have common interests there. But that's okay. I mean, I think you've got to start first by sort of building trust and confidence, and then you can build out from there. So we'll continue to very much to work with the Chinese and exchange views and see if we can try to work more closely together.
Well, I'm telling you when you're
sorry?
When you're ready.
Okay.
I agree about the commonality on CARIC, the transport of China. But that's already more than almost 15 years old. It has been a success. They have opened up, which was the objective, the transport routes between China and Europe. You spoke about U.S. policy, which is trying to add to that by opening up the transport routes via Afghanistan and Central Asia between the Indian subcontinent and beyond,
right,
and Europe. Here is a case where the continuing of all this money to CARIC is basically killing your own policy of getting that redirection of ADB resources to these other routes. China is doing just what it should do. Hats off, it's in our interest. We should declare victory on that. But we, rather than being in that cheering section, which we should have been pushing through the board of ADB to open up these other routes and to redirect international financing to that. And we've wasted.
Sorry,
years.
What other routes are you talking about, Fred?
From the Indian subcontinent and beyond, across Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Central Asia, right through the Caucasus. We've never really got hold of that because the biggest tool for achieving it, which is the ADB, we've tried to make adjust CARIC, which can't be adjusted. It is a China-Europe project. Now you need a new CARIC for the Southern, and our failure to do that, it seems to me, hurts them and hurts us.
Well,
and
I guess
it doesn't benefit. China would benefit from this as well,
yeah.
Not just India.
I guess I would take a slightly different view, which is that, in the case of trying to encourage the South Asia trade with Afghanistan and Central Asia and beyond. The key obstacles are not really so much policy problems. It's infrastructure and things like that. It's more a policy question, and particularly getting the Afghanistan-Pakistan Transit Trade Agreement first implemented, and then even more importantly, eventually convincing Pakistan that it's in their own interest to allow transit trade from India, from Bangladesh, and the rest of the subcontinent through Pakistan to Afghanistan and beyond, then you will really have something interesting. As you know, we have the beginnings of that in the sense that India and Pakistan have made quite substantial progress in their trade. Now that we have a new prime minister in Pakistan who is committed to moving ahead on the trade front with India and to moving ahead on most favored nation status, that's going to, I think, have quite a positive impact on trade between India and Pakistan. But again, the next big challenge will be to take the next step and allow direct transit trade through Pakistan into Afghanistan.
And build the railroads.
Yeah. But to do that, we have to overcome the trust deficit between India and Pakistan with respect to Afghanistan. And so that's a larger problem that still has to be dealt with. And so, but once that, I'm very hopeful that will happen, but it's going to take a little bit more time. And once that does happen, then there will be automatically the incentive to develop those rail links, the road links, and all the other things. And I'm confident that there will be sufficient private sector money that can help to drive those things, because there's such a clear opportunity to drive that.
Kathy Cosman, U.S. Commissioner of International Religious Freedom. Thank you so much for your comments. When you were discussing freedom of religion and belief, you didn't mention that Uzbekistan has been named CPC back in 2006, and I was wondering how that fact factors into your bilateral discussions.
It factors in the sense that it gets raised at every opportunity by the government of Uzbekistan that they'd like to be removed from it. And, we've shared all kinds of ideas with the government of Uzbekistan about the kinds of things that kinds of steps that they could take that would enable us to take a review of this. But so far, they haven't been willing to do that. But it's not for lack of effort, I assure you. There's been a great deal of dialogue and discussion about this. And I remain hopeful that they will that they'll be willing to look at this. But I must say, we haven't made much progress so far.
One more.
Hi, thanks very much. This is a question about both Afghanistan and NGOs and the constraints on them. And certainly Hillary Clinton did so much to raise the profile of women in the State Department. And I'm wondering, what do you think can be done to encourage the administration now in power to give some heed to increasing constraints against women's freedom in Afghanistan?
Well, just because Hillary Clinton and Milan Verveer, both of whom were incredibly dynamic leaders, have left, it doesn't mean that there's going to be any less attention to this. And I know that very soon the administration is likely to announce Milan's successor, and certainly John Kerry needs no encouragement in this regard. He's been a very strong supporter of all these efforts. So I think you're going to find continued very strong encouragement of this. And I'll say, just in my own bureau, we've tried to do the same. I mean, as you know, we had a big conference in Kyrgyzstan about 2 years ago to try to bring together and establish women's empowerment networks, particularly on the business side, to try to develop those links, not only within Central Asia, but also with their Afghan counterparts. And I think that's bearing some fruit. I mean, that's still, it's like everything else, it's sort of a work in progress. But the first thing is to establish those relationships, and then hopefully to give them access to finance of various kinds. And then over time, you're going to see those develop, hopefully, into women-owned businesses and so forth. But I think we've made a good start on that, and we'll just have to sustain that. And I can tell you there's a very strong will on the part of the administration to do that.
Bob has to go back to making policy. Please, please join me in thanking him for explaining the policy.